You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Joe Henry is a super producer, singer, and songwriter. His much acclaimed recent album is The Invisible Hour. You were hearing a little bit of it. And he's also produced dozens of other artists. He brings out, I think, the best in artists when he works with them. Some of them include Mavis Staples, Bonnie Raitt, Alan Toussaint, Mose Allison, Annie DeFranco, just to name a few. You should check out his website. Joe is also the co-author of Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him, which we also have on sale tonight, and he'll be signing afterwards. It's a fantastic read. Roseanne Cash's beautiful memoir, Composed, is an eloquent testimony to the power of song, love, and human resilience. And the honesty that she brings to her memoir is also there in her songs. She's one of the country's preeminent singer-songwriters and the author of 4 books. And among her many honors, Roseanne was recently inducted into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame. Joe and Roseanne are two artists who both bring joy and awe to their work. In life, as in song, Joe has commented, we're really called not to dispel mystery, but to abide it, to engage it. So tonight, let's listen in on two artists talking about their lives as discovered through music, through song. Please welcome Roseanne Cash and Joe Henry.
Good evening.
Well, good evening. We're both very honored that you would choose to spin the apocalypse with us here this evening. I never knew it was going to go out this way, but here we are. When Louise first approached me about curating an event for this evening, Roseanne's name was probably the first one I said out loud to her over coffee one morning, because I think Roseanne not only is a great artist and working as such in real time, but I think she can actually talk about it and not destroy it, which is a more difficult thing than it sounds.
It's not like a very high bar.
Well, that's you should talk to more people. I think it's extraordinary, you know, how few people can actually talk about the creative process without dispelling the mystery that Louise was alluding to a moment ago. You know, I think every single creative endeavor, you know, began as an act of storytelling. We as human beings are desperate to signify and to recognize and to leave something behind us. And I think song is the first and the ultimate expression. You know, it's the incredibly human thing to give voice. And I think in our contemporary culture, we've overly narrowed our field a bit. You know, we all know people who say, you know, when I was growing up, you know, the nuns at school told me, you know, you just move your mouth. You don't sing because you can't sing. You know, we have a very narrow idea of what it means, you know, who's allowed to sing. Who's allowed to give voice? Who's allowed to represent us? You know, here's a great artist, which means that there are some that we're going to acknowledge as being less. And I think that as song got refined, we started finding ways, we were hungry for ways as a culture to talk about the things that are completely undefinable. And when you use words to talk about abstraction, it's confusing to some people, because if they hear that you're using words, there's a tendency to think that this has already been translated. This shouldn't be confusing to me, because this is already an experience that's been reduced to a word that is now shareable. So the idea that some things in life that are by their own nature mysterious and you have to approach them and articulate them in ways that are equally mysterious so that you don't stand outside of that experience but within it. That's the place where we talk about how song form meets the poetic mind. And by the way, I'm doing this explaining because I'm the one who got us into this thing, and I thought it might be rude just to throw it to Rose immediately. But all to say that when I refer to the poetic mind, I'm talking about people who are writing, people who are working, completely focused not on expressing something that's, you know, been preconceived, you know, so that you're just showing up to read it into a public record, but you're engaged in a process that is about discovery, you know. I'm not sure that anybody writes anything terribly meaningful if they knew when they began what they were going to say. It's not about having an idea and then making it pretty so that people can walk away with it and share it conveniently. The act of writing is the act of finding out what you're writing about.
E.L. Doctorow said that in a different way.
Where's he tonight?
He said that writing a novel was like driving a car at night. You could only see as far as the headlights go, but you could get all the way home.
You could get all the way home.
Yeah.
Well, that idea of engaging something that in its inception is by its nature foreign and elusive. I would begin by asking Roseanne, when you start writing anything, because you don't only write songs, do you know or do you even want to know when you begin what it is that you're doing? Do you understand the form? Have you decided? Do you have to know what you're after?
No, I definitely don't have to know. If it's different categories, if it's something commissioned, like I wrote a piece for the Oxford American and they wanted me to write about something about the South, so start thinking about that, and I ended up writing a piece called The Long Way Home about, and in three separate parts, about three different Tennessees that I've known in my life. Well, I didn't know I was going to write that. You know, it took a while to get there, and it took actually being in the midst of writing it to know that's what I was going to write. Songs, even more so. I mean, I'm working on something now, and I like stealing from Shakespeare. In fact, I have a note on my phone called Stealing from Shakespeare, and when I see something good in Shakespeare, I just put it in. So I'm writing a song. I should might as well say, I mean, whatever. I'm writing a song called The Undiscovered Country, and, you know, just playing off that line from Shakespeare, and I didn't realize that it was going to be about setting ghosts to rest in the past so that you could be in a real love affair in the present. That didn't come clear until I was finished with the fourth verse, and then I went back, went through it to make the rest of it work with what I now saw was the theme. And I'm sure that happens to you all the time.
Well, I find it really easy after the fact. If you have that first initial burst of, I hesitate to use the word inspiration because it's not usually that romantic when it happens.
No.
You say that at a cocktail party later. But when you're first working and something, an idea presents itself as engageable, you know, I find it, I try to stay completely out of the editorial mind. You know, John Cage spoke frequently about how essential it is not to confuse the creative mind with the analytical mind. That if you begin writing or creating anything, if at any point in that work you are thinking about how it works, who it might work for, who's going to like it, will it make me any money?
Yeah.
You've stepped completely out of the river, and you're standing up on the bank looking down at it, but you're not in it, you're not of it. I find it easy once I've spooled off that first raw fabric, whatever that first burst of idea might be. It's really easy to go back later and tailor that into a pair of slacks that you can wear. But the idea that you can manage that or should be controlling that in process is absolutely death to that process.
You know, I wanted to, when I was making my album Interiors, I was so sick of the sound of my own voice and the sound of my own thoughts that I took up painting because I just wanted to do something that didn't have language or notes. And I found that the process of painting was exactly like writing songs. There came a point when this critic came in and wanted to dismantle the whole process. Oh, this is crap. This will never be any good. I'm just going to give it up. I'm never going to be Picasso. So why am I doing this? But I started noticing the stages of work and how it was identical to songwriting, and it just revealed everything to me about that process, about where the inner critic comes in, how it can completely dismantle you so you don't finish the song or finish the poem or finish the book. And then I realized that I could put that critic in my service by asking it to come back at the end of the process to help me edit. And I even at that time, I called it the committee, all those voices, and I drew the committee and made the committee into a T-shirt. I swear I did. So that I could see them in front of me and get them out of my head. They don't bother me as much. What?
I said you don't want to be standing with them all the time, that's for sure.
No.
Well, certainly for me, if I find myself, you know, evaluating, if I find myself even thinking about, whether I'm about to ruin something that started off so well, you know, that's the biggest indicator for me that I'm sort of done for the day. I've certainly worked, and something seems to be really speaking well, and it seems to have its own energy that's working on its own, and I'm sort of attending to it. But at the moment when I start wondering how it's working, and is this so good that I'm afraid that the next verse is going to make it null and void, that fear mind takes you so completely out of creative process. And in regard to song and poetry in particular, I think what we mean when we distinguish between song form and poetry that works, that's created to work on a page in some kind of silence, there's still its own musicality in your mind as a reader. You know, you're hearing the texture and the physical sound of words. There's a musicality that is part of the engine that drives poetry the same way that it drives music. But when you're writing a song, you're more fully articulating, or at least you're invited to fully articulate, you know, that musical stream upon which, you know, a lyric might ride. But poetry is, by its nature, is a musical form. It has a musicality to it. I think that's how it got remembered, you know, early on, when people wrote in strict meter and in rhyme. And I also wanted to ask Roseanne about rhyme, because almost all the songs that I write rhyme. But I write poetry also, and I wouldn't dream of writing poetry that rhymed. I'm quite uncomfortable reading it, in fact, if I stumble across it, even if it's really old. There's something that's so antiquated for me at this point about the way that which rhyming poetry is devoid of the music that I mean to hear, mm-hmm. that I think I'm supposed to hear, that we no longer have access to, because that river has split so fully in our culture, in our modern times, how we think of song, how we think of poetry. I would say that most people I know who aren't themselves poets are afraid of poetry. They think it's unapproachable. It wasn't always like that, you know. Song is ubiquitous, and we don't have any fear of that. And even a challenging song, we feel pretty free to engage it and brush it back if it doesn't work for us. But poetry has become, somehow in our culture, we think that it exists at a separate plane above song. Like if you're a songwriter of a certain sort, some people will say to you, well, you're not just a good songwriter. I mean, you're a goddamn poet. And that's like getting a field promotion. They've just so much just elevated you, as if a great song isn't as great as the greatest poem ever written. Because I'm here to tell you that it is.
I had people say after I wrote my first book, they said, "Oh, now you're a real writer."
Mm, yeah.
Like, oh man, 25 years of writing songs, and now I'm a real writer.
If someone says to me, "Oh, you're a poet." I know that what they really mean is that song is really pretty and I have no idea what it is that you're saying. Because there's a certain, as I was saying earlier, there's a certain, there's a quality of charged poetry that transcends and is supposed to transcend, it has to transcend linear thought. Mm-hmm. And I think we've lost some of that driving wheel as songwriters in our contemporary culture because it hasn't been properly nurtured. It's not been properly celebrated and acknowledged. But I think it's important to understand the authority of that element that works subversively upon you and completely slips by the gatekeeper of your conscious mind. And I don't say that, you know, I certainly don't write songs that I think that are deliberately difficult. I write songs that I understand, because I get some mail, that it's elusive, it's unapproachable, it doesn't connect. But I still try to stay in that free zone where language has a musicality beyond its literal definition, if you know what I'm saying. That we use words and we tend to think of them as already, you know, formed, translated thought, so that when lyric itself paints impressionistically, it throws us because we haven't been, you know, taught to abide that discomfort of not knowing and how powerful it is to not know when you can go pretty deep into a story before everything is all the dots are connected for you.
Well, I'd say there's also melody and prose. I mean, and, you know, great writers, you can tell who it is just by the melodic sense of how their prose flows, you know. I mean, James Joyce's prose is like no other, and Hilary Mantel is like no other, and their rhythms are very particular. And when I'm writing prose, that's what I try to think about is, as a songwriter, how would I write prose? Where's the melody in it? Where are the hard consonants falling? Mm-hmm. Is this sentence too long so it's now kind of bloated and falling apart, and would it get tighter and more rhythmic if it was like this? I mean, that's how I write prose because I started as a songwriter. But the thing you're saying about poetry, it is true. I mean, I get afraid of poets and poetry. I had a residency at the Library of Congress three years ago, I think, and one of the nights was a conversation with the poet laureate. It was Natasha Trethewey at the time, and I was scared to death. This was going to be a moderated conversation, and I thought, this is the poet laureate, you know. I write folk songs. I don't know what to say to her. And we almost instantly bonded by talking about process. It was exactly the same. My process was just the same as hers. And what we were just talking about that confusion, the inspiration and confusion at the same time, where's it going? You feel your way through it. A critic comes in, oh, it's no good. Okay, I'm going to stick with it. It becomes clear. There's this aha moment. And then you just have to do the nuts and bolts to get to the end.
Well, because, you know, sound itself has meaning. You know, the sound of a word leaves an impression upon you.
Yes.
Not just the meaning that is carried along with that agreed upon word. And, you know, as record makers, we're always thinking about sound, and I'm always having to invite people to stop thinking about a sung voice being a completely different animal than the other music that's happening in the room, you know. You know, this is the most ancient, you know, followed quickly by drums, I assume, but this is the most primitive music maker, you know, of all time. You know, we give voice, we make sound, and sound carries meaning. And that idea that you can be disoriented. We were talking in the drive over this evening about the great short story writer Alice Munro. We're both great fans of hers. And, you know, we were talking about, she has the most, for me, the most recognizable writing voice. I know her anywhere. And yet, she's completely conversational. There's nothing heroic about her word choice, but there's a musicality to what she's doing. And just to continue the thought about disorientation, I think that she deliberately disorients me all the time. Mm. You're reading along, and then from one paragraph to the next, 10 years have gone by in this character's life, and nothing is there to alert you to that, except you have to go deeper into the story and realize that the point of view has drastically shifted in some way, and you piece it together. And that I don't think that disorientation is accidental. I think that bit of free fall as a reader is crucial to being vulnerable to that particular experience that she's painting.
You actually do that very well. That's that sense of shifting time and scenes that collide, characters, unexpected meeting. You do that really well.
Well, thanks.
Congratulations on
think
that.
Thank you. I think, you know, the greatest artists of the world, you know, whether it's Picasso or Robert Johnson, you know, put the past, present, and the future all in the same room together. You know, there's sex, love, God, death, you know, fear of all manner, seated at the same table in real time. And I think the art that lasts is the art that keeps all that confused and sustained into real time. As soon as we think we understand what it is, there's a big part of it that's lost to us. And by the same token, you know, as writers, you know, you pick images, they're not always faithful. You know, they don't always remain meaning the same thing that they meant when you chose it. And, you know, our mutual friend Loudon Wainwright years ago wrote a song where he referenced O.J. Simpson running through an airport. And very shortly thereafter, that was a completely different visual that was conjured by that song. He was an unfaithful image in that way. And at one point I was writing a song. The song was called Like She Was a Hammer. And there's a phrase where I refer... Well, thank you. There's a phrase in there that refers to Roosevelt's funeral in the street. And when I first wrote it, it was Kennedy's funeral in the street. But except for two things. Kennedy doesn't sing nearly as well as Roosevelt. That was just a problem. But also, we're not really sure completely what we think yet about the Kennedys. I didn't trust Kennedy as an image. But I think we know pretty well where we've parked Roosevelt and what his funeral moving through the streets might mean as an image. I don't mean to talk too much, but it's how I was made. The same strange guy that turned me into a musician turned me into a big talker. I would like to ask Roseanne to sing a song for us, because that's part of why we're here.
Which song?
I'd like you to sing The World Unseen. And the reason I ask for that is because I think that there is a really powerful balance going on in this song between something that is incredibly specific. And I believe I know the impulse behind this song's writing. So there's a really concrete foundation for the song, and yet it is in no way nailed to the floor. The whole thing floats and defies quick sort of translation, and thus it's impossible for us just to think we've heard it all and tuck it away somewhere, you know.
Well, I usually don't explain songs before, but since that's
library.
What we're talking about, this song was on my record Black Cadillac, which I made. A lot of people in my family died in a very short period of time. And I started writing these songs about death and mourning and just the landscape of loss. And I was a little self-conscious about recording the songs and putting them out. They felt very raw. And I thought, oh, who's going to want to listen to an album about death, the whole album? And then before the record came out, I went to Paris, and there was this show at the Grand Palais called Melancholie, 800 Years of Death and Madness in Art. And I went through the show, all of these rooms. It was chronological, so it started very early. Went up, Dante and all of this dark, crazy stuff, and then death and these mise-en-scene of like skeletons and stuff. It was so fantastic. It was so liberating. And I thought, this is what we used to do with art. We used to put death and madness and grief and loss and everything in art. And we didn't have to medicate ourselves out of it in all the various ways we medicate ourselves. And I medicate myself with Outlander, by the way. That's what I medicate myself with. But anyway, to see it all in art was so freeing. And I went back and I didn't feel self-conscious about putting this album out anymore. So this song, I started writing shortly after my dad died. And I'd written the verses and I couldn't write the chorus. And it was Christmas time, and I took my kids to Christmas services at the Episcopal Church where they went to school. And they sang that old hymn, "Westward leading, still proceeding, God is to..." And I went, "Oh, that's it." So I took those lines and I put them into my song, figuring that it was so obvious people knew I was stealing that I wouldn't get in trouble for it. So, stealing from Shakespeare, stealing from hymns. You know the saying, though.
Yeah, I do.
Anyway, this is called "The World Unseen." I wouldn't have chosen this, but Joe asked me to. I'm the sparrow. I'm the list of everyone I have to lose. I'm the rainbow in the dirt. I am who I was and how much I can hurt. And I will look for you in stories of the kings. Westward leading, still proceeding to the world unseen. I'm the mirror in the hall. From your empty room, I can hear it fall. Now that we must live apart, have a lock of hair and one half of my heart. And I will look for you between the grooves of songs we sing. Westward leading, still proceeding to the world unseen. Wrapped in a winter laid beneath the ground. You must be somewhere in the stars. Cause from a distance comes the sound of your in morphine and in dreams, I will look for you in the rhythm of my bloodstream. Westward leading, still proceeding to the world unseen.
I'll play something, and then I want to talk a little bit about place. I think in a lot of poetry and a lot of song, the natural world leads us into a certain realm of understanding, as does geography. I'm going to play a fairly new song that sort of just grew out of describing the natural world that was around me in a very particular moment. But I understood as I was going, you know, into whatever this place was, that the journey of the song was to talk about romantic love in religious terms. And I think I only got there in that act of trying to describe, you know, what was sacred about a particular moment in a physical space. This is called Believer. Way down in a low place, yawning into field, skirting now the river, pushing water, further falling, lower still. Oh my word, oh my captain, oh my ghost stepped in to view. My disappeared redeemer's lost believer seen in you. Lost believer seen in you. Steering wide of shelter, flung afield and out afar. With eyes that play and shine and give away just what savages we are. Oh my stars, oh my dear lonesome, all the least that I can do. My rearranging strangers, finest danger seen in you. Finest danger seen in you. For the starlings in air and at your feet, commanded by a weather to be gathered, one calls forward, then retreat.
Oh, my witness, my revolution, marching headlong into blue. My creature now forgiven, my reliving scene in you. My reliving scene in you. My reliving scene in you. My
thank you. Thanks.
What tuning did you have that in?
That's an open G tuning.
Nice. You know a lot of chords. You
do. Who knew?
More than I do.
I want to ask you very much about geography. Roseanne's most recent record, as I understand it, is about her relationship to the South, which she is both from and not from. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I seem to recognize that you went back on purpose to see if you could find yourself in it.
Mm. Yes, although that's not what I thought I was doing in the beginning, but that's exactly what it turned out to be. I lived in New York. I grew up in Ventura, by the way. But I've lived in New York City for 26 years, but I was born in Memphis, and I thought it was anecdotal, you know. I didn't grow up in the South. But going back to the South a lot in the last several years, partly because Arkansas State University bought my dad's boyhood home in the New Deal era colony in Arkansas where he grew up, and they wanted to restore it, so the family got involved in fundraising. And on the first trip down that I went down to help them out and to do this fundraiser, Marshall Grant died, who was the original bass player in the Tennessee Two, my dad's Tennessee Two. And I was close to him my whole life. He always said, reminded me that he was the third person to hold me after I was born. So being down there, and he was going to be in the show that night, and he played his big stand-up bass at rehearsal, and then he had an aneurysm that evening. So I saw him play on the last day of his life. The last day of his life, he came to rehearsal, which, you know, for a musician, it was so moving. And that was one reason we were going down, is the Arkansas project. And then we were going to Alabama. I have a girlfriend in Alabama, Natalie Channon. She has this workshop where she hand makes these beautiful clothes. And I wanted her to teach me to sew. So I went down, and she was threading my needle. And John, my husband, was doing this little iPhone video of our hands when she was threading the needle. And she said, "Honey, you have to love the thread." And I started crying. It's like she was not speaking in metaphors, but I heard it that way. So then I wrote a song based on that line. John and I wrote a song based on that, and we wrote a song about Arkansas, the sunken lands. We wrote a song about Marshall and Etta Grant. Marshall and Etta were married for 65 years before he died. And John said, "This is something we can write about, you know, these characters that are so viscerally just huge, and the places, the geography that's kind of haunted and deep and with violence and beauty and, you know, terrible ugliness and poetry. There's so much in the South." But I didn't want to point fingers and go, "This is bad about the South, and this is really beautiful." I figured that people, I just wanted to point the direction of art, of the South itself and the art that came from there, and not ignore what happened. I mean, there's one song Money wrote about Emmett Till and about Robert Johnson. But yeah, I did find a lot of myself there. And it was, you know, in midlife, you want to know who you're from and where your people come from and what that means. And, you know, to go and see my where my dad grew up, my grandmother raised 7 children and picked cotton and had no electricity. And I thought, I am a modern woman and live in New York City with every amenity. I couldn't live her life. And yet, what about her survives in me? What do I have that's hers? So making those connections was profound, and on a personal level, and then there was a lot of music that grew out of it.
Well, I'm myself from the South, and I moved from there when I was quite young, but both of my parents were from Charlotte in North Carolina, where I was born. And until I was 15 and realized that I could say no, I was dragged back every summer and every Christmas of my life.
You got to say no at 15?
15. Well, I had a 17-year-old brother who said no.
Oh.
And I just said, I'm with him. You know. But I spent a lot of my boyhood life, once we left Charlotte, I was in Atlanta for a while and wound up in the Midwest, came of age in the Midwest. And I spent a lot of my childhood resisting with every fiber of my being what I recognized to be my Southernness, because nothing I carried with me that I associated with the South was I proud of. And I didn't want to see myself in it. I resisted it in every way I could. And I thought I did a pretty good job of it. I reconciled myself to the Great Lakes area in Michigan, where I wound up as a 15-year-old. And it wasn't until maybe, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years ago, my wife was talking to me about my songwriting, and I don't know what inspired it. I think I had played the night before or something, had a show the night before. And she said, I finally get it. You're a Southern writer.
Wow.
And, of course, I'd schooled myself on great Southern writers, but always from a distance. You know, I thought what I got from Eudora and from Flannery O'Connor was you know... I had access to it. I had an understanding of that language, but it wasn't my language. But not until my wife, you know, put the finger on it and said, "That's your tradition. That's where you come from." Did I start allowing myself to consider in a conscious way that like it or not, that's a part of my fundamental lens, mm-hmm. And I'm trying to. You know, I mean, it helped a lot when I learned that Nina Simone was from North Carolina, and so was John Coltrane, and that was a big kind of get out of jail free card for me. But I would just say, before I'm going to ask Rose to sing one more song, I've been working recently with this wonderful African American songwriter and singer named Liz Wright. If any of you know who Liz Wright. Well, we spent last week together kind of digging through a lot of songs for her. And she said to me this very morning on the phone that she is trying to find a way. She's an African-American from Georgia originally, lives outside of Asheville now in North Carolina, to find ownership in the South for herself as an African-American. And it was such a startling concept to me. It's not like it's... It doesn't sound like a big idea, except that when I heard it this morning, it was enormous, that she would be trying to reconcile what part of the South was authentically hers to embody and to love. Mm. And it took me right back to school to think about what my ownership has to be and how I don't mean to be such a savage gatekeeper and try to limit myself to what my experience might be saying to me.
You should put Savage Gatekeeper in a song. That's good.
That is the kind of song I would write, yes. But I wanted Rose to sing something from the album she was just describing, because I think it's...
Well, I was going to do... I think I'll do Modern Blue. Do you want to play it?
Please do.
Do you know how to play it?
I don't know it well enough.
Do you want to fake it?
Well... You're in... Your fourth fret there?
Yeah, fourth fret. When you hear a chord you know, just play it. This is called Modern Blue. Do you know it? went to Barcelona on the midnight train. I walked the streets of Paris in the pouring rain. I flew across an island in the northern sea. And I ended up in Memphis, Tennessee. I keep my head down, I keep my eyes on you. It's a big wide world with a million shades of modern blue. Everybody around here moves too fast. Feels so good, but it's never gonna last. Everything I had is twice what I knew. But I don't have nothing if I don't have you. I keep my head down, I keep my eyes on you. It's a big wide world with a million shades of modern blue. Will you still be there when I round the curve? Will you hold my hand when I lose my nerve? Oh, I went to Barcelona and my mind got changed. I'm heading back to Memphis on the midnight train. I keep my head down, I keep my eyes on you. It's a big white world. I keep my head down, I keep my eyes on you. I keep my head down, I keep my eyes on you. It's a big white world with a million shades of modern blue. Thank you.
We're going to stop this one-way conversation. We don't like this theatrical fourth wall.
You need to do one more song. You've only done one song.
Well, that's okay.
Yes.
Well, I'll do a quick one. Actually, I don't have any quick ones. That was a
just play it fast.
This is a song that I wrote sort of in the musical vocabulary of a standard, because I think the songs from the Great American Songbook as form, have power, just like we recognize blues form to have power. Like haiku as a form has power. We recognize that. But we've sort of gotten away from a certain song form that was a driving train through a big part of certainly my parents' lifetime. Okay, this song is called After the War.
A dogged mind sniffed my heart like a pocket full of German marks. Long after the war was through, stood me on a rusted rail, turned my face and kicked my tail up towards the yonder blue. I threw a fish up on the bank. I watched him dance from the air he drank, and then my hunger knew that sparks will fly around my head when I stir coals down in my bed. Like I was walking back to you. Well, time slips out the leaning fence that lost the border ever since our beloved war took to the road. With caravans and mockingbirds and painted girls with twisted words whose knees and ankles show. Now I sit and watch the failing moon, the shadow stars and coming soon. The whole thing will look new when blessedly I will forget the ways of God and all regret. Like I was walking back, like I was walking back, I thought I heard somebody say, tow that bar. I thought I heard somebody say, lift that bale. Well, I drank a lot of liquor and I land in jail. But that old man River, he just keeps walking on back to you.
Thank you.
Joe, that's fantastic. Thank you.
So now this fourth wall comes down, and we'll take questions from any of you as long as you keep a civil tongue in your head.
I'm from Rome, Georgia. So I'm thinking about, I always say all roads lead from Rome. But I'm thinking about place and ambivalence about that. Yeah. In California, our best native writer is Joan Didion. Her last memoir was called Where I Was From, right? But I'm also thinking about Tom Petty. There's a Southern accent where I come from.
Loved that record.
Or Quentin Compson in Absalom, Absalom saying, I don't hate it about the South. And I'm thinking about, Roseanne, your song, The Long Way Home.
Yeah.
I thought I left it all behind. Right. And so I think everyone's ambivalent about home and everyone's ambivalent about the place they left. But I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that specific song, and maybe both of you can talk a little bit about kind of where I was from. Right.
Yeah. The Long Way Home on the River and the Thread, that. I really found out that home was bigger than just where you live, that it's a lot of places you take with you and people you take with you and the very geography, how that feels, how it makes an imprint on your cells even, and this, the way people talk. And, you know, sometimes I hear a certain kind of Southern accent and it makes me feel at home because I loved people who spoke like that, you know. And so I get home, you know, if I am... a Marriott that I've been before. You know, I'm on the road so much. I go, oh, this, you know, can I make this feel a little bit like home? Yeah, it looks just like the Marriott that I was in, you know, a month ago. No, that's just silly. But in The Long Way Home, I mean, I've never really talked about this, but it's a library, so maybe I should tell. I have a daughter who's had a lot of problems through her youth. And when I was writing that song, I kept thinking about her. The song was about what you're talking about, but it was also, I kept thinking, she's made the long way home to come back to herself. And the you took the old religion from the woman on the hill, that line in the song, that was my mom, because my mom was Catholic, and I left the Catholic Church, and my daughter became Catholic. So I wrote that line for her, you took the old religion. But, you know, I found, too, that you don't really, when you're in your 20s and 30s, you don't care about your ancestry and where you came from and who you're connected to and all of that. But in midlife, it becomes really important. You know, the wall between you and your mortality starts to come down, and you want to know where you came from before you leave. And that's kind of what that song's about. Anything to add to that?
I'm not sure I have much to add to that. I mean, you know, it's true that we ever, you know, we think of our identities as portable in our youth. You know, we carry it with us, and we sort of re-ratify truths for ourselves as we go on in real time, and it ultimately catches up with you. You know, the fact that you have joined something already in progress, bigger than yourself. You know, you came from a place, you came from a tribe, and it's left a mark on you. And you know, you're not a free agent, even though it's a deep part of our American culture to think of ourselves as unattached. You know, we all left something somewhere back there, you know, with the idea that now we are, you know, we're nomads. But there's I think we all, as human beings, have a deep desire to feel of a place. And as Rose, you know, just said, when you get to be a certain age, it's more significant than I realized as a young person, you know, how much of my identity belonged to that. Because I joined a tribe cosmically of musicians when I was quite young, because I'd moved so much, I didn't feel attached. I didn't believe I was attached, except to this sort of spiritual tribe of musicians that told me who I might be. I didn't think of that as place, but I recognize it as place now. Who else has a?
I guess I'm old-fashioned, but I still like poets who rhyme. And I was wondering if what you thought about some of my favorite poets who rhyme, and would this disqualify them because they rhyme? In particular, Leonard Cohen and Sting.
They're not disqualified.
No.
There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
Yeah. No, I don't. I have no authority to disqualify anybody, and I don't really like talking about things as good or bad. For me, it's just like, does it penetrate me? And maybe for the very reason that I write in rhyme as a songwriter, that's how I first distinguished my voice as a poet, if I have one at all. It's not developed in the same way that my songwriting voice might be, but maybe that's just the way I compartmentalized for myself, you know, when something was working on me like a poem, when something was working on me like a song, and what did that tell me about how I needed to invest myself in the work accordingly. I mean, I do love a lot of you know, old poets from the deep past that worked in rhyme, but there's something about the decision on paper to be free of that kind of structure that reads to me like supreme confidence. You know, I'm not adhering to this. The idea is bigger than this structure, and I'm following that, and I'm seduced by that.
I'll say one thing about rhyme schemes. So I do guest teach in songwriting classes in colleges really fairly often, and I talk a lot about rhyme scheme. Like, if you don't, you better know how to make a really tight rhyme scheme and do it well. And then if you want to throw it away, fine. But even Picasso knew how to pencil draw before he did abstracts, right? And I know some songwriters who are so ruthless about their rhyme schemes. I was writing the lyrics to the song on River and the Thread called When the Master Calls the Roll, and I wrote the lyrics with Rodney Crowell. And I mean, I have a good work ethic as a songwriter, but we came to the end of the song and there was going to be a soft rhyme. And it wasn't even that soft. It was like, let's see, hold on. I got to think of this because it's a good point. Oh, I forget. It was away and change or something like that. And he couldn't go for it. He said, you can't get to towards the end of a song and use a soft rhyme. It's got to be a hard rhyme. It's got to be a hard rhyme. So we argued about this for a while, and we came to a compromise. But sometimes young songwriters, they'll write a song, and the rhyme scheme will just be a mess. And I'll sit, and then that's when I turn into mean teacher. Yeah. It's like, if you don't know what your rhyme scheme is, you know, I can't respect you. You can throw it away, but I'm not. Go do something else.
This is probably songwriting 101, but I was curious, do you hear the music first? Does it arrive simultaneously with the words? Does it change? Each of you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I would say it happens every which way. It does happen every which way.
Yep.
And the results can be sort of radically different. I mean, I'm very lyric oriented, but at the same time, I would never call a song finished if I believed that the music was just incidental to, if it was just scaffolding that brought a listener up to the power of whatever I thought this word might be. It has to ultimately feel inevitable that you cannot separate the word from the music any longer. For it to be finished for me. If I write something that's based on a melody first, I think the results are really different than when I have a lyric that sort of arrives and offers itself, you know, unattached. But then, you know, there's once in a while that really, really great moment, and those are invariably my favorite songs, where they just seem to show up
together,
completely intact as if you found it. You know, in fact, you know, I think a lot of us spend time after those songs arrive wondering where we stole it, because it seems so complete that we think, well, I must be pulling this from somewhere else, because I can't account for it otherwise. You know, I mean, there's a part of that process that is inherently mysterious when something shows up and as an idea, and you feel very much like you're taking dictation, and it's an unbelievably real high when that happens.
It does happen always. I think if you could predict it, it wouldn't be songwriting. It would be something else, because the element of mystery is, you know, central to songwriting. But Tom Waits told this great story that he's talking about getting it from somewhere else. And a lot of songwriters believe that songs are complete somewhere else and that you get the songs that your skills can handle. But Tom Waits told this story that he was driving on the freeway and he was hit with this idea for a song, but he's going 65 miles an hour. And he just, in frustration, he says, "Can't you see I'm driving?"
Well, there are moments when songs arrive and you feel like it's, you know, you sort of get one shot at that initial burst. You know, it's like in the Jack in the Box, you know, it only pops out one time. And I've spent a lot of time in those sorts of moments where I felt like there was something really great to be seized, and there was just no opportunity for it. I mean, I have children. There's all kind of work to be done all the time. And I've spent a lot of time exercising that muscle of not allowing the song to happen, not allowing the idea to offer itself. I can feel that it's there. I think it's really good, and I don't have one goddamn minute for it right now. So I have to keep this from uncoiling right now, because it'll never get taught again, and it'll never be the driving force that it might be when it offers itself up. If you let it spill over the floor like a box of dried pasta, you can spend all day picking it up, and it's filthy. There's nothing you can do with it. But you go back to that moment, if you can be awake to it when it happens, you know, it is its own sort of driving machine. And then you just sort of, you know, you sort of just hang with it.
We all read a lot of stories, and we don't have much experience with songwriters, so this is very special. And my question is, how do you write a song which is such a complete story that's not 350 pages long? And my second question, if you want to address this, Roseanne, is you've had both sides now. How did you feel at the end of your story, your memoir?
How did I what?
You've written a memoir.
Yeah.
So can you share a little bit about the difference with your experience from the songwriting experience, how you feel at the end of a conclusion of a story through a song, and when you were finished writing this much longer narrative that you had much more opportunity to express yourself, perhaps?
Well, what you said about telling a complete story in, you know, 3 minutes with a tight rhyme scheme, that is why songwriters are real writers. I don't, that person who said we're not real writers, but it's hard to do, and those narrative ballads are the ones that always captured me too, you know, Appalachian and Celtic ballads that told these long war stories and longing for home and the travel and you know, death and all of those scenes and narratives laid out with a melody and rhyme. That's just, there's nothing like that to me. It's so thrilling. Writing a book was different, obviously. I was looking for melody, like I said earlier. I felt a little at sea in some ways, like there's so much space and I'm not going to rhyme anything, and I could really, this is a lot of rope, you know. But ultimately, it's the same thing. It's that, you know, when it's right, you know, and sometimes it's like Natalie Goldberg talked about turning a line over in your hand like a stone over and over and over until it was smooth, until it was right. And it's that feeling, you just keep going until you know. I mean, I look at some songs now, I go back and think, ugh, I wish I hadn't said that word or that line. I would write that differently now. Can't believe I wrote that. But they are as they exist because that's what was happening at the time, and that's as perfect as that song could get for that time. Once in a while, I'll change a line singing a song in concert that's really old, just, you know, like, to see if it works better, but it never does. Or I forget a line, make something up.
I mean, I came to songwriting, I mean, I came to be awake to songs in narrative form. I mean, as a very young boy, I was completely infatuated with a certain kind of song that didn't necessarily tell the most linear narrative. The first, you know, hunk of vinyl I ever bought with my own money, you know, as a 7-year-old in Atlanta, I bought a 45 of Glen Campbell doing Galveston that Jimmy Webb had written.
It's a great song.
And it's still a masterpiece of writing. And I didn't understand as a boy that this character was in the war, was in Vietnam. I heard that much later, but it didn't matter. It worked on me exactly the same way. It penetrated me, and it worked its alchemy on me, and I didn't need to know. And that's probably what's helped liberate me to write songs that are you know, where I try to leave all the doors and windows of that. You know, if a song is a house, I try to write songs where all the doors and windows are sort of perfectly ajar, so that people can enter them and leave with things however they need to, rather than painting, you know, creating this one big front door and say this is the way into this story, because that's not how stories actually get told by us to each other. You know, there's a sense that when we're getting down to the real formality of writing, that everything gets addressed and made clear, when in fact the greatest stories stay great. You know, when Ezra Pound said that poetry was news that stays news, you know, he was talking about that thing that's open-ended enough that it can always be evolving. I mean, there's songs that I've been listening to for 40 years, I promise you, and I do not know what they're about. But there's something about them that continues to nourish me, and I ask myself all the time, why is that working? Why does that happen? You know, how does that stay evolving in real time with my evolution? And to me, as a writer, that's the, you know, that's the goal. You know, the ultimate goal is to write a story that's specific enough to engage you and open-ended enough not to close anybody out of it. Oh.
Yes, question to both of y'all. The Gid Fiddles, is the young lady there, is that steel string? And vice versa to the young man yonder, is that a steel string or nylon?
No, they're both steel string guitars.
Thank you very much.
Sure. You know, I was going to, with your permission, I'm going to invite that we close. I'm going to read you a very short poem that I love, and then we're going to sing a short song that we both love, because I think that they get at exactly the same thing in really similar ways. In both cases of this poem that I'm going to read, which is by the poet James Wright, where he's looking at the natural world, feeling himself of it, connected to it, and yet isolated from it because of some personal conflict that has allowed him to feel alienated. And yet there he is surrounded by what he recognizes as to be the only world that he knows. It goes like this. I'm going to have to put glasses on. This is called Lying in a Hammock at William Duffy's Farm in Pine Island, Minnesota. Over my head, I see the bronze butterfly asleep on the black trunk, blowing like a leaf in green shadow. Down the ravine, behind the empty house, the cowbells follow one another into distances of the afternoon. To my right, in a field of sunlight between two pines, the droppings of last year's horses blaze up into golden stones. I lean back as the evening darkens and comes on. A chicken hawk floats over, looking for home. I have wasted my life. Oh. Now we're going to sing a musical version. We'll sing the musical version of that song, as far as I'm concerned. And you'll find yourselves uplifted by it, because it's floating on.
Do the second verse.
You do the second? You want to do this? You do the first, I do the second.
Okay.
Can be very humble.
Hear that lonesome whippoorwill. Sounds too blue to cry. That midnight train is wild and slow, and I'm so lonesome I could cry.
Did you ever see a robin weep when leaves begin to die? That means he's lost the will to live.
I'm so lonesome I could cry.
Go ahead and say that. I don't mean anything fancy.
The silence of a fallen star lights up a purple sky. And as I wonder where you are, I'm so lonesome I could cry. I'm so lonesome I could cry.
Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Loud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.